It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan's take on the GOP health care bill and other key issues in Washington.
First, countries throughout Europe were hit this week by another round of computer viruses that have wreaked havoc on computer systems throughout the region.
Ukraine bore the brunt of the cyber attack called Petya, and it was originally suspected to be a ransomware attack. However, cybersecurity experts around the globe now think the attack could be significantly more destructive.
Debbie Perulli is with us now to talk about the Petya attack. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Mathematics, Statistics, and Computer Science at Marquette University, also a part of Marquette's Center for Cybersecurity Awareness and Cyber Defense. Debbie, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Veronica and Rob. Thank you for having me.
Well, when did the world first become aware of this new Petya attack?
Soon after it hit on Tuesday, and the first spot, like you mentioned, was in Ukraine. And after that, it started spreading. I believe Microsoft has mentioned in 64 countries so far. So it was really soon after the attack launched.
And what is it that Petya does?
This particular attack, it will be more proper not to call it Petya because, exactly like you mentioned before, it's not really ransomware.
Mm-hmm.
What it does, it's pretty much that it wipes the hard disk and all of the files that are in that system. So it is a very destructive malware, malicious software.
Well, initially, it was reported that this was something pretty similar to Petya, and it was ransomware, and it was urging people to unlock their files, directing them to pay some money via Bitcoin. When did it become clear that it was something else?
There were a few hints that this is not the traditional type of ransomware from the very beginning because, for instance, when there was the payment method through Bitcoin, the only Bitcoin address that was provided, there was only one Bitcoin address. And this is fairly unusual because it makes the job on the attacker's end much harder to collect the money. Another hint that this is not a ransomware attack, or at least a typical one, was the fact that there was an email address associated with that Bitcoin address, and it was urging the victims to contact the attackers on that email address. This is also not typical tactics. So these were a few hints, and then because the software is quite complicated, researchers, for example, the Kaspersky Labs, started looking into the code and seeing what exactly it does, and they found even more evidence that this is not actually a ransomware. One of the reasons that we believe so is the fact that there is a long sequence of characters, an identification, let's say, for its victim, which is necessary in order for the attacker to decrypt the files. So if the victim says, yes, I'm going to pay, and then the attacker decides, okay, I'm now going to give you your files back, this is the ID that the attacker would need in order to do that, to decrypt the files. So researchers found out that this particular identification number, which appeared on the screens of the victims, was pretty much a random number, was meaningless.
Mm.
So having that number, the attackers would not be able to recover the files. And this is a pretty significant piece of information to tell that this is not ransomware. Apart from that, there were also a few other technical details from the way that the code was structured and what it was doing that showed that this is really not ransomware. It appeared as such. It wanted to have the cover of a ransomware, but it was not, in essence, a ransomware.
So based on everything that you just described, what do those little breadcrumbs tell us about who might have been responsible for this attack?
This is usually very difficult to say, with 100% accuracy and confidence. And this is one of the reasons that many such cyber attacks in the past, there haven't been any formal finger pointing and accusations. Usually we try to see what kind of tactics were used, what the target was, what the motivation might be behind it, and so forth. So you have already seen in the news that Ukraine, pretty much from the very beginning, said that Russia is behind this cyber attack. And there is good reason to believe that from their point of view, because Ukraine was the country that was hit the hardest by this cyber weapon. On the other hand, there needs to be really a lot of technical analysis to see the forensic evidence, the digital evidence, to be able to say for sure who was behind it. And that usually takes a lot of time. It has to do with examining the IP addresses that the software came from. I believe there was one news story that mentioned that was an IP address from a block of addresses used in Iran. But even that is not, you know, the end of the story. Someone could be doing IP spoofing and trying to masquerade behind Iran. So for the moment, the short answer is that we don't really know who did it. There is definitely going to be a lot of analysis and a lot of research trying to figure out. And again, like with the previous ransomware attack that we saw in May, the WannaCry one, there has been some evidence that North Korea was behind it. But again, officially, NSA has said nothing. It's only unofficial words that we're hearing.
We're talking with Debbie Peruli right now from Marquette University. She's part of Marquette Center for Cybersecurity Awareness and Cyber Defense. And we're talking about this recent cyber attack sweeping multiple countries and looking at why attacks like these are on the rise. And Debbie, with, for instance, ransomware, you can see that there's a monetary benefit for what's happening there. In this case, what is the goal? Do we have any idea what the motivation was behind this attack?
Well, initially, since this appeared to be a ransomware, the number one reason for having a ransomware is exactly like you said, to collect money. And in the past, we have seen a lot of such attacks collect an impressive amount of money. However, in this particular case, although the software that attacked the victims was really complicated, a piece of serious workmanship, the mechanism to collect the payments was rather unsophisticated, and it had a lot of failures in it. Like we said, there was a single Bitcoin address, there was a single email address, and that even the email provider just took it down. So since this was not really a ransomware as it initially appeared, the goal of that was definitely to disrupt. It was to wipe out machines, was to pretty much destroy. Now, who was behind it and why? It could definitely be a nation state behind it. We have seen similar attacks in the past that it would be reasonable to assume that they came from a nation, one nation against the other. But at this point, again, it's too early to say anything with confidence.
Do you have any sense about why it seems like we're seeing an increase in cyber attacks like these?
There are three reasons that come to mind. First of all, we have a lot of anonymous payment services available these days. So we have Bitcoin, we have PaySafe, MoneyPack, and similar services. So it is easy, those make it easy for attackers to collect payments without being identified. On the other hand, and this is one of the worst reasons, unfortunately, is that cyber criminals these days don't have to know a lot in order to be able to write such cyber weapons. They can just buy a crime kit from in dark web trading sites, software that someone else that has the expertise was able to put together and then sell for some amount of money, or sometimes, as it has appeared in the news recently, maybe it is software that a government put together and then it was stolen. So these days, cyber criminals don't have to have amazing technical knowledge in order to perform an attack. They can find, they can buy those crime kits. So this is, I would say, reason number two. And probably reason number three, at least in my mind, is that although the value of the digital content has increased in our life, we haven't really developed the mental habits to behave safely in the digital world that we have entered. So we don't teach ourselves how to keep ourselves and our digital assets safe. We don't teach our children how to do so either, because many times we ourselves don't know how to do it. For example, how many times do we tell our children not to become Facebook friends with individuals that we don't know in the real, that they don't know in the real world? Or, you know, don't share personal data with someone, again, that you don't know in the real world. Don't put on your profile information that is too private.
And we leave it there. Debbie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And of course, one way to keep your computer files accessible to you, back them up. And if you have Microsoft, install that patch to stop this attack. That was Debbie Perulli, assistant professor in the Department of Mathematics, Statistics, and Computer Science at Marquette University. She's also part of Marquette's Center for Cybersecurity Awareness and Cyber Defense. And she joined us today to talk about the most recent cyber attack sweeping the world and why attacks like these are on the rise.
One of the biggest issues in Washington this week has been the GOP health care bill. The vote on the bill was delayed after Senate Republicans encountered opposition, including from members of their own party.
Mark Pocan is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which is based in Madison, and he's co-chair of the House Progressive Caucus. He's been vocal about his opposition to the Senate health care bill and said that it would be bad for Wisconsin.
He joins us now to talk about that and some of the other latest news from Washington. Congressman Pocan, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, the plan has changed somewhat between the House and the Senate version. What is your take on at least the current state of the Senate health care bill?
Well, I think it's important first to note that the current state of the current bill in the Senate is not all that different than the House bill. I think the best analogy I can make, if you were in a river and you saw a giant pair of jaws coming at you, you wouldn't decide, is that a crocodile or is that an alligator? Either way, it's going to get you, and that's kind of the difference here. You know, while they may have shaved off a million people from losing access to health insurance, still 22 million people are going to lose under the Senate version of the bill. And according to the Center for American Progress, that means about 394,100 people just in the state of Wisconsin. So it still has all those bad parts of it. It still has the giant tax breaks for the wealthiest and for big corporations and big pharma. It still makes older Americans pay five times more than others. It still has these deep, deep cuts to Medicaid that's going to affect all sorts of people. So I think, you know, the fact that they're still trying to figure it out in some ways is a good thing. I think the more time people look at this thing, you know, we saw two polls this week that 12% of the people supported it. Another one was 17% of the people supported it. That's generally not a good turf to be in if you're a politician and trying to put in a bill together. So I think, you know, we just got to keep the pressure on so that people don't lose access to health insurance while they're trying to really do tax reform. And that's exactly what the Senate and the House have been trying to do this year.
Republicans have said through this process, you're comparing this to our plan, to our nice version of what might happen with the Affordable Care Act. In fact, they say we're seeing insurers drop out of many markets, premiums going up and up on the exchanges. We're on a collision course now. We need to do something different. What do you say to that?
Yeah, and I think that's where Republican Senator Susan Collins said there's a collision, but there certainly are things we have to fix about the Affordable Care Act. First of all, let's remember 20 million people now have access to health insurance that didn't before. If you have a pre-existing condition, you now can get access to health insurance, which is what you need because you have a pre-existing condition. Now, we don't have lifetime caps on your health insurance, so women aren't paying more than men. So those are all benefits of the Affordable Care Act. But on the actuarial side, some of the healthy people didn't sign up. There's some other issues that we need to address, but that's all fixable. So when you have people like a Republican senator saying, let's go back and just fix the Affordable Care Act, I think that's the wise way to go. And that's where Democrats also want to do that. But to, you know, really just try to provide this giant tax break so they could start the rest of their tax reform and do it under the guise of health care, because they've got to take away those the taxes that paid for the Affordable Care Act, you know, that's never going to get them a health care plan. It's only going to drop people from health care.
If you had the opportunity to work with Republicans on fixes instead of a replacement to the Affordable Care Act, what kind of changes do you see needing to be made?
Yeah, I mean, clearly the most obvious one is actuarially healthy people didn't sign up like they were supposed to, and you need that to smooth the market, right? Because people who needed health insurance signed up and now are getting that, and that's a good thing. But to help make the costs be covered, you got to make sure that people who are healthier also have it in place. So, you know, that's one area that's very, very obvious. I think there's a lot of other smaller things we can do. And I would even argue, although I think it might be hard to get done with this Congress, if you had a public option like many people wanted to do in the beginning, you would actually have competition everywhere then, because you'd have an alternative for people, and that would keep the market more competitive by having that. So I think there's a number of things you could do to really solve the problem and not have it so that people lose access to health care. The problem is the Republicans aren't even in that realm.
There is a Democratic plan in the House. I believe Senator Bernie Sanders is planning to introduce something along these lines, more of a single-payer approach. Do you think that should be part of the conversation?
Well, I'll tell you, the public is already there. I think we're the ones who are a little behind. There's a bill that John Conyers from Michigan has that's the Medicare for All bill. That's the bill that Bernie Sanders has in the Senate. And there are 112 sponsors right now in the House of Representatives, more than they've ever had, because we're hearing it from our constituents. Gwen Moore from Wisconsin and I are both on that bill. I'll tell you, when I do a town hall in my district, or the couple I've done in Paul Ryan's district, inevitably, when you talk about health care, it gets to a single-payer system. And I'll be honest, that gets the largest response of pretty much any issue you talk about at a town hall these days. So I think what people are seeing is, rather than fighting over all the problems that we have at the current system, the best way to do this would be to do what Canada and so many countries in Europe do: make healthcare a right, make sure that every one of your citizens has access to it.
Now, you publicly applauded Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson for calling for more time and consideration of this plan. Content-wise, I think he wants to change the Affordable Care Act more than you do, though. What is your take on his role in this?
Well, I think what's important is that they didn't vote on it this week, because if you vote on a bad bill and both houses have a bad bill, what's going to happen is you're going to move forward with a bad bill. And the more time you have, the more sunlight you have on it. Like I said, this week alone, we saw there's, depending on the poll, 12% support or 17% support. That's telling you we're not, right now the Senate and House Republicans are not listening to their constituents. And the more time you have, the more time constituents have to get in their ear and tell them what they really want. So I think anything that buys us time is helpful. And to Senator Johnson's, credit, there's a lot of pressure on Republicans these days to just pass this thing, and he was one of the reasons why there was a delay. And in the end of the day, we want to go in different ways. But the fact that he said correctly, we need a more thoughtful process, I give him credit for that.
Talking to Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan, we've been talking about the health care debate in Washington, now turning to some other issues in the national news. On Twitter yesterday, Congressman Pocan, you backed a petition from Representative Joe Crowley of New York to stop the deportation of Carlos Humberto Cardona, an undocumented immigrant who had helped clean up hazardous material after the 9/11 attacks. Why are you signing on to this?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot of people in this country who right now are facing deportation for a lot of, I think, bad reasons. This particular individual was someone who was one of the people who helped clean up the 9/11 site, took in the toxic fumes, has had health concerns for that. He left Colombia to flee violence 30 years ago. And because of a drug conviction 27 years ago, they are trying to deport him. And, this is the kind of illogical policies. We want to make sure our borders are protected, and we're all for making sure we have some strengthened measures there. But there are people just like this individual who's been in every way an extremely productive citizen that we should help find that pathway for citizenship. But you shouldn't be deporting someone like this, especially a 911 responder, just because of a 27-year-old drug conviction. That makes no sense. So I think, if I heard right, and I could be wrong on this, but I thought there's about 22,000 people they think that are in this category. We're trying to stand up at least for this one person. And if I understand it correctly, he may have been let out of custody. I don't think we have resolution on his case now, but yesterday he may have been let out of custody at least, and I think that's some progress.
Staying on the issue of immigration, the U.S. Supreme Court issued not really a ruling exactly, but they allowed the president's travel ban partially to go into effect and said they'd consider it full on in the autumn. There's debate over how many people now will fall under this ban on travel from six Muslim-majority countries. What's your reaction to that Supreme Court decision and efforts now to implement that today?
Well, I think the implementation is going to be where the devil's in the details. How much disruption does this cause? I was just talking to someone who works with U.S. travel, and, after the first time the ban was put in place, there are $185 million worth of cancellations to the United States. And what they're saying is they're having a hard time having conventions and meetings, international ones in the U.S., because you don't know who's going to be allowed in and not. So there's this whole movement to have things in Canada and other places. And this is all because of the uncertainty that's been caused by Donald Trump rather than having a coherent policy and waiting till we get a final decision on all of this. So unfortunately, I think there's this more disruption, more loss of to the economy and to jobs in Wisconsin and across the country because this president's moving things forward without even knowing if they're legal.
I want to get your reaction. We're hearing from a lot of people in Congress about the president's statements on Twitter this morning, criticizing the hosts of the Morning Joe show on MSNBC, called out their names and said that one of those, Mika Brzezinski, was, quote, bleeding from a facelift while at his Palm Beach resort around New Year's. Republicans and Democrats responding to this. Your quick thoughts.
Well, you know, this it's bad enough the president tweets so often for many, many reasons. But then when he adds in the sexist behavior, the talking about women's physical appearances and things like that, you know, this is just not presidential. He, you know, calls them all nicknames, saying they're not, you know, they're stupid, and he talks about their appearances. This is fine if you're a reality show star who's just doing things in the shock, you know, category. But when you're the president, you're supposed to be a little bit presidential. And I'm just waiting for this guy to understand what job he signed up for. He's no longer got a reality show. He's now the president of the United States, and he has to start acting like it.
Very briefly, a couple weeks ago, we had the horrible shooting targeting some of your Republican colleagues in the House. Has there been a change in tone?
You know, I think there has been a little bit of a change in tone in that, you know, people realize that we all are, at the end of the day, we should be in this for the same reasons, and maybe that was a little bit of a reminder, a wake-up call. The problem is, we don't see it then in actions. If that was part of it, they should be reaching out to Democrats on the health care bill, for example, where we could actually do something together. So it was a brief, short-lived maybe moment. But, you know, I do worry that when Republicans are you know, afraid to have town halls because they don't want to face their constituents on the health care bill, they're now using this as an excuse. And I think at some point you relieve the pressure when you actually face your constituents and do your job. And I think, you know, they're using this in a way that could make things continue to have a lot of pressure on what people think about members of Congress. And I think, you know, they need to go out and meet their constituents.
Thanks to Congressman Mark Pocan. He represents Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out about promising new technology that's speeding up the process of discovery for scientists working with fungi.
First, it didn't seem like it was possible, but relations between the Trump administration and the press got even worse this week for a variety of reasons.
It started when CNN retracted a story about a meeting between Russian investment agency officials and an associate of the president, and possible Senate and Treasury Department investigations related to that meeting. CNN said the story, quote, did not meet CNN's editorial standards. Three journalists involved in the story resigned on Monday.
The president responded on Twitter with attacks on CNN and other media outlets, including this statement, quoting, so they caught fake news CNN cold, but what about NBC, CBS, ABC? What about the failing New York Times and Washington Post? They are all fake news.
Things got tense at a White House press briefing this week. This is spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Maryland editor Brian Karam.
If we make the slightest mistake, the slightest word is off, it is just an absolute tirade from a lot of people in this room. But news outlets get to go on day after day and cite unnamed sources, use stories without sources, have, you know, you mentioned the Scaramucci story where they had to have reporters resign.
Come on, you're inflaming everybody right here and right now with those words. This administration has done that as well. Why in the name of heavens? Any one of us, right, are replaceable, and any one of us, if we don't get it right, the audience has the opportunity to turn the channel or not read us.
I think you
have been elected to serve for 4 years at least. There's no option other than that. We're here to ask you questions.
Right.
You're here to provide the answers. And what you just did is inflammatory to people all over the country who look at it and say, see, once again, the president is right and everybody else out here is fake media. And everybody in this room is only trying to do their job.
Well, I disagree completely. First of all, I think if anything has been inflamed, it's the dishonesty that often takes place by the news media.
And then this morning, President Trump attacked the hosts of the MSNBC show Morning Joe, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, after they had criticized him for having fake copies of Time magazine featuring him on the cover on the walls of his resorts. Here are the presidential tweets, quoting, "I heard poorly rated Morning Joe speaks badly of me. Don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ crazy Mika, along with psycho Joe, came to Mar-a-Lago three nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no."
This week's events were just the latest in a long series of conflicts between President Trump and media outlets.
Jim Warren joins us now. He's chief media writer at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies and columnist for Vanity Fair. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, pleasure, guys. I just listening to the excerpts you played and realizing I'm sitting up in northern Michigan at the moment. We keep thinking that the president has crossed a line. And I, when I heard the comments or saw the tweet about Mika Brzezinski this morning, I said for about the 100th time in the last year and a half, oh, he's done it this time. He's crossed a line, that this somehow will be the time, that the moment that things change. Then you have the almost now predictable hand-wringing of even a few Republicans, such as Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina this morning or this afternoon, who then don't tend to follow up. But then nothing changes. It's like, you know, lather, rinse, and repeat.
Let's start with those tweets then. And this has been a question since the campaign started. How is the media supposed to deal with presidential tweets, tweets that people often say are unpresidential tweets? So what do we do with them? Do we treat them as serious news? Do we say, as some people, they're a distraction from real issues? What's the media to do with that?
Well, say if you're the New York Times and Washington Post, you've got you literally have a new process in the early mornings by where you've got sort of almost all hands on deck to be on the lookout at 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. Eastern time for these things, and then you quickly treat them as you would any declaration by the President of the United States. Doesn't mean you go to print with them or put them online instantly, but you make a quick decision about whether something is newsworthy. And more often than not, like this morning, they've been newsworthy, and it's almost head-turning how quickly a lot of outlets produce copy this morning. But yeah, you bring the same values you would and same sense of judgment on these sort of things as you would any formal pronouncement, and then decide, is this worth a story?
We'll get more into some of the content of those tweets and the relationship it spells out. But I want to start with the thing that I originally called you to talk about, the CNN retraction of the story. They'd been talking about an associate of President Trump's. So he'd had a meeting, and he acknowledged this meeting with a Russian investment group, reporting that was being investigated for some reason. CNN says, hey, this did not meet our sourcing standards. We're retracting it. Three fairly prominent journalists, have accepted their resignations now. What went wrong with that story that got retracted?
We still don't really know all the details. I was just about an hour or two ago emailing a pundit friend at CNN and said, okay, what exactly happened here? Was there a phony source? Was there a phony document which, three, veteran professionals fell prey to? One largely has, CNN's, pronouncement that internal standards were not heeded. But as far as the substance of it all, one is simply led to believe that Mr. Scaramucci was unfairly linked to a Russian bank. And it's sort of interesting, if folks have really been following it, how Scaramucci, even on one of the primary organs for the Trump administration, Fox News this morning, on his favorite show, in fact, Fox and Friends, Scaramucci was on, and continues to sort of take a high road, and said he accepted their apology, didn't want to go much further than that, thought it was unfortunate, but certainly didn't take the rhetorically bellicose attitude that a lot of Trump allies have.
Now, when a major outlet like CNN realizes they've got this story that doesn't meet their standards, did they handle this right, this public retraction apology, and then I don't know that the journalists were fired, but they resigned and CNN accepted their resignations?
Yeah, without knowing, I've been a newspaper, mostly newspaper manager for a long, long time besides being a reporter, and I was sort of surprised with the rapidity of all this, how quickly they took an action. So my first reaction was, oh my gosh, TV tends to move rather slowly on ethical matters. I would argue historically a lot slower than elite newspapers like the Chicago Tribune, where I worked for a long time. But this happened very, very quickly. and in some measure had to also reflect the spotlight that Trump and allies have placed on them.
And then President Trump and one of his sons and other administration-connected people have kind of painted this incident over a lot of mainstream media now, saying it's all fake news, and especially Russia investigation-related stories are fake news. What do you make of their response?
Well, I think it's predictable and clearly part of a strategy to appeal to their base and really, nobody else by, having this caricature of the evil mainstream media and then finding what is clearly patently a false equivalence between some of the mistakes that clearly the press has made and what have been a year and a half, almost 2 years of outright rhetorical deceits and lies by the president. So the clip you played from Sarah Huckabee Sanders' press briefing the other day was a perfect example. And one should note, followed by 2 days, an astonishing full page in the New York Times, not an ad, but a piece by, the Washington Bureau labeled Trump Lies, that simply went over all the lies that the press of the United States has told simply since January 21st of this year. And if one also looks at the Washington Post, wonderful fact checker, a guy named Glenn Kessler, I mean, I think he's up into the hundreds since the campaign began. I mean, he's like some 24/7, Walgreens or Rite Aid. I mean, he doesn't seem to have any downtime when it comes to fact-checking then-candidate Trump and now President Trump.
So what are you looking for from the White House press corps? I mean, apart from that angry exchange we saw in trying to, I guess, hold the White House accountable, ask questions in situations where sometimes they're on camera, sometimes they're off camera, on the record, off the record, kind of a moving target there.
Well, exactly that. You continue attempting to ask the tough questions. Don't necessarily, though, be beholden to their flacks for any great repository of truth. And you just try to work the story as hard as you can. I think, a lot of time can be wasted through what amounts to kind of quasi stenography by a lot of the folks who live in that room, and a lot of the best reporting is done from folks outside it. But this is a really tricky period of time we're in, and one of the most head-turning bits of data or polling I've seen was done a few weeks ago, or released a few weeks ago, by the Pew Research Center, and it shows how only a year ago, Democrats and Republicans basically had a similar view of the role of the American media. When you ask them, should they serve a watchdog role, roughly about 70% of Republicans, 75% of Democrats agreed with that. That's only about in January or February of 2016. That now has dramatically changed on the Republican side. That figures down into the mid-40s, and it's clearly a result of the president and his allies having made the strategic decision to make an issue out of the mainstream media and gratuitously bash them every chance they have. Make no mistake, this has had real impact on what a lot of Americans think about us.
We're talking to Jim Warren from the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, looking at the latest news on the media and President Trump.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to CNN retracting a story earlier this week to the confrontation at a White House press briefing, to the president's tweets this morning about a talk show host and a bleeding facelift? Big picture, is the media too hard on Donald Trump, or vice versa? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're continuing our conversation with Jim Warren, chief media writer at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. And we're looking at a rough week in the relationship between the press and the president. And that includes a CNN retraction and resignations, and a tense exchange at a press briefing, and another controversial presidential Twitter statement.
You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page, what do you think of the conflict between the media, much of the media, and the Trump administration? 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I cannot be silent any longer. I really do see a lot of trolling going on, and it's been going on, and it goes right along with the statistics that say that the Republicans have lowered their view about, you know, where they've lowered down to 40% now, and that is reflective in how they've been trolling and putting out the fake news so that it is picked up by the other media. We've been watching this going on in all these different channels of it, and it's really atrocious. But I really believe they're doing it as a force of propaganda, because that way they can get control of what's out there by making it all fake. They're throwing the problem out so that they can twist it and work it to their advantage. And that has been their mode of operandi. You can see it, you can hear it, you can watch it.
Gail, thanks for the call. So, Jim, she's saying the administration and allies in the media are basically propaganda operations at this point.
Well, I think that, you know, whether you call it propaganda or not, it is clearly part of what they deem a very self-serving, premeditated, unceasing, 24/7 strategy. It is their strategy. They're going to continue. They're going to play to their base. But, you know, when you look at what appear to be his record, the president's record low approval ratings, you know, it begs the question, to what end? And when you look at what has gotten done, or I should say not done, in Congress legislatively, it raises the question, okay, fine, to what end? You now have even, you know, what, 12 or 15 or 20% maybe of Republicans buying into the Senate Republicans' health care proposal. I mean, that's nothing to click your heels over if you're in the West Wing.
Gail, thanks for the call. Go next to Steve in Cascade. Steve, hi.
Good afternoon. Say, I run a business, and this is what I think. I think that all the people in the news media don't know what's going on west of the Potomac River and should grow up. I think the president should grow up. They act like 12-year-olds. We're trying to run businesses in this country and employ people. Let's get to work as a country. I appreciate excessive journalism. I don't appreciate just sensationalism and everybody's having a fight against each other.
Got it, Steve. Thanks for making the call. Jim, what do you think? President and press grow up. The public doesn't care about these back and forths.
Well, I think there, you know, for sure, as you saw in the campaign, there is, you know, frequent disjoint when it comes to the media and how they cover the country west of the Potomac. I mean, I think once again, and I don't want to paint with too broad a brush, there are some vivid exceptions. There's a Madison native and friend of mine, David Marinus, who back in the winter of 2016 did an absolutely fabulous job going all around the country and catching that anger. But I do think that there is a professional fault that we commit a lot in when in campaigns, in covering the candidates, not the country. And I think there are real questions about whether, you know, folks west of the Potomac want to hear 24/7 about, you know, the Russian influence in the campaign, whatever the merits of the case would be. But, you know, take a look at cable news, particularly CNN and MSNBC. You don't have much of a sense of much else going on in the world except what's happening with Donald Trump.
Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. We're talking to Jim Warren from the Poynter Institute for Media Studies, looking at the press and the president. Back to your calls now. Patty is with us in Superior. Patty, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My opinion is that I think our president is a bully. I think that he, just look at his behavior. You don't have to read in any tabloid about what he says. If you listen to what he says in the video and you can see he's saying these words, the way he treated the German chancellor when she was here was embarrassing. I mean, I don't have enough time to go on about the behavior of the president. I find it quite embarrassing.
Patty, thanks for the call. And so it is for Patty worth focusing on the president's behavior. What do you think, Jim?
Well, to me, the most interesting question remains, you know, go to, you know, say, counties in, say, southern rural Wisconsin and take a look at some of the folks who voted for him, and then tell me whether they have been impacted by, you know, this behavior up to this point. I think polling suggests for many of those folks, no, certainly not yet. It seems to me that the key question will be, at some point, will the campaign promises about jobs come to fruition? Until then, I think a lot or a fair amount of this stuff, including, you know, his behavior, as vulgar as it may be, and it doesn't get any vulgar than this morning with his tweet about Mika Brzezinski. But, you know, I think for those folks, I think more important than this is going to be what happens to this economy.
Patty, thanks for the call. Eric is with us next in Eau Claire. Eric, hi.
Hi, just going off of the job statement, I mean, everybody in the administration, including Scott Pruitt, who came out like a couple weeks ago and said that there was a 50,000-person increase in coal jobs, and then it came out that there are only 50,000 coal jobs in the entire nation. These fact-checkers, the media need to be able to give us the correct information, and the entire administration is coming out with lies. It gets really tiring trying to figure out what's true and what isn't.
Eric, thanks for the call. Jim, you mentioned a PolitiFact earlier. How important are fact-checking operations these days?
Well, they're hugely important. They have grown. They're growing, one should note, worldwide, so it's not just in the U.S., but it still begs the question of what happens in a world in which a lot of adherents to, say, Donald Trump feel that whatever certain elements of the media print or air, that it's some, to them, alternative reality and they're making it up. I mean, when, you know, if you showed the full page in the New York Times Sunday on Trump lies to folks in the White House, they apparently would say, no, just untrue. It's all made up stuff. I mean, you know, imagine, you know, dealing with your kids in a situation like that. You know, you got to teach folks right and wrong. And right now, there has been an increase, especially on the Republican side, especially among conservatives, of folks who disdain and reflexively mistrust anything that is produced by a certain realm of the American media, and it is unfortunate to say the least.
Jim, one more angle I wanted to get into, and just a bit of time left, the use of anonymous sources in reporting on the Trump administration, your thoughts, your guidelines for people out there trying to cover things.
Well, that's a question for editors. And, you know, certainly in the best of all worlds, particularly when folks are being nasty and negative about people in public life, you would like folks to have the nerve and the moral courage to go on the record. But, you know, if they're not, those are decisions you got to make on every separate story. You got to sit down with a reporter, talk to a reporter on the phone, say, okay, who are these people? I do cringe, and it's not just in reporting on elected officials. It's reporting on corporate officials. It might even be reporting on manager of a baseball team. Sticking it to somebody anonymously, I think that's dangerous.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Great. My pleasure, guys.
We've been talking to Jim Warren, chief media writer at the Poynter Institute for Media Studies. He's also a columnist for Vanity Fair. He joined us today for a look at the latest news, and there's been a lot of news this week in the ongoing conflict between President Trump and the press. You can still share your thoughts. You've got a couple media options of your own. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Love to hear your thoughts on some of the topics we've brought up here with Jim. The use of anonymous sources in White House coverage, the conflict between the press and the presidential administration, tweets from the president. Should the media cover those? How should they cover those? What should they do with them? And the thing that started our conversation, CNN's retraction of a story related to the Russia investigation. Share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page. Today is National Handshake Day, a day to look ourselves squarely in the eye, presumably there's a mirror involved, and admit whether or not we have a decent handshake.
Now, some people say first impressions count a lot, and many first impressions, well, they often include a handshake. And so there are a lot of different styles here, from the dead fish being a pretty common one to start off with.
And then, yeah, we're reading up on this today. There's also people classify the dead fish the bone crusher, which in my experience, I haven't dealt with a lot of people who do this, and I don't do it. It's not a good idea.
Oh,
it's
I've
not
definitely experienced it.
You've experienced
like, when
it.
When you experience it, you remember
you know.
It.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, there's the middle ground. And then there's my thing where, you know, I don't have to shake a lot of hands. Usually it comes up every
You're
now and then.
More of a hugging guy.
Right, right. Not, no. But it seems like whenever I have to shake hands, I've just washed my hands. You know, they're still a little damp. Or I've just put on hand sanitizer. I just spilled something like coffee on my
You've
hands.
You've just
or something
been
like that.
Eating green beans with your fingers.
With my fingers, which
gummy.
I do by the vat.
I know.
As we remember.
Oh, I know.
And so it's like, but you don't want to say no. Yeah, I don't know. Handshakes can be an awkward moment.
I try to strike the right balance. Uh-huh. But the thing I do is that I tend to mirror the handshake. So if someone's a dead fish, I go a little dead fishy. And if someone's a bone crusher, I try to squeeze really hard too. But yeah, I don't know. It's hard to find that perfect middle ground.
I say just get rid of the handshake. A polite nod.
Fist bump?
Works for me. A fist bump I'm okay with.
All right, we'll try some of these new things. You're listening to Central Time.